Oh, boy, oh, boy, I'll tell you. This kind of weather makes a man a dangerous animal, doesn't it, Don? A dangerous animal, this warm, soft, soupy air out there. That great big fat moon hanging. Did you see that moon with that soft, drifting cloud hanging there in front of it? Oh, boy, old Shep took one look at that. His eyes narrowed to mere slits. And he is ready to go all the way, all the way. Dear Mr. Shepherd, it's that side of you that I really enjoy. My husband Charles and I have often spoken of the soft, sentimental side that obviously is part of your upbringing. Your mother must have been a wonderful woman. For years, we've been John Gambling fans and have been listening to WOR since Mr. Bamberger first put it on the air. And for a while, we thought that you were going to be a bad one, I must admit. But lately... Yes, I can. Come on, bring up that sentimental blob, please. It's summertime. All right, then you know how to set it back, Don. I'm going to have to take out of work the machine there. Now you hold it there for a second, and we'll get ready. Oh, boy, this weather is just... It brings it all out. It brings it out in a cold sweat. And, of course, it brings out things which you don't often want to have to stand up and literally face. I see it's comforting to know that the city's urban renewal program has hired the Botch Reconstruction Company to repair and remodel some of the property there. I noted that one. Funny, you know, how people's names often fit exactly what they do, and I it's very scary, terrible scary thing. I once worked for a guy named Emil Thug, and I don't have to tell you that Mr. Thug did not operate one of the better Sunday school classes. Oh, for the benefit of those of you who were bugged the other night because I did not finish Maud Muller on a summer's day, I was deluged with people who said, "Mr. Shepherd, we insist on sending you copies of Maud Muller." And here it is. It's summer. Let's face it. It is now summer. It is time for all kinds of dangerous things to begin happening. Lillard, in 5 minutes tonight, I heard more action down on Hudson Street than I have heard in months down there. Fire engines, guys with the U-lights going up there, people yelling and hollering, fights breaking out on the up on the fire escapes already. The first day, summer hasn't even started. And I think it's going to be a wild... All set now? Maud Muller out there? Are you all ready out there? Sport fans, huh? All set. Bring it up there. We will recall days of yore. Days of yore. When sentimentality was simpler. When morality was clear-cut. And people knew just exactly what they were. All set now? There were many things in the future when this was written. Dorothy Kilgallen was not even thought of. No one could have possibly have imagined it. And things were very different. Ed Sullivan was not even a theory in those days. Norman Mailer had not come up over the first hill to begin the big dust kicking up. Maud Muller on a summer's day raked the meadow sweet with hay. Beneath her torn hat glowed the wealth of simple beauty and rustic health. Singing she wrought, and her merry glee the mockingbird echoed from his tree. But when she glanced to the far-off town, white from its hill slope looking down, the sweet song died, and a vague unrest and a nameless longing filled her breast. A wish that she hardly dared to own for something better than she had known. The judge rode slowly down the lane, smoothing his horse's chestnut mane. He drew his bridle in the shade of the apple trees to greet the maid and ask a draught from the spring that flowed through the meadows across the road. She stooped where the cool spring bubbled up and filled for him her small tin cup and blushed as she gave it, looking down on her feet so bare and her tattered gown. "Thanks," said the judge. "A sweeter draught from a fairer hand was ne'er quaffed." He spoke of the trees and the grass and the flowers and the singing birds and the humming bees, then talked of the haying and wondered whether the cloud in the west would bring foul weather. And Maud forgot her briar-torn gown, her graceful ankles bare and brown, and listened, while a pleased surprise looked from her long-lashed hazel eyes. At last, like one who for delay seeks a vain excuse, he rode away. Maud Muller looked and sighed. Ah me, that I the judge's bride might be. He would dress me up in silk so fine, and praise and toast me at his wine. My father should wear a broadcloth coat. My brother should sail a painted boat. I'd dress my mother so grand and gay, and the baby would have a new toy each day. I'd feed the hungry, I'd clothe the poor, and all should bless me who left our door. The judge looked back as he climbed the hill and saw Maud Muller standing still. A form so fair, a face more sweet, ne'er hath it been my lot to meet. And her modest answer and graceful air show her wise and good, as she is fair. Would she were mine, and I today, like her, a harvester of hay. No doubtful balance of rights and wrongs, and weary lawyers with endless tongues, but the soft low of cattle, and the song of birds, and the help of quiet and loving words. But he thought of his sisters, proud and cold, and his mother, vain of her rank and gold. So, closing his heart, the judge rode on. And Maud was left in the field alone. But the lawyer smiled that afternoon when he hummed in court an old love tune, and the young girl mused beside the well till the rain on the unraked clover fell. He wedded a wife of richest dower who lived for passion as he for power. Yet oft in his marble heart's bright glow he watched a soft picture come and go, and sweet Maud Muller's hazel eyes looked out in their innocent surprise. Oft when the wine in his glass was red, he longed for the wayside well instead, and closed his eyes on his garnished rooms to dream of meadows and clover blooms. And the proud man sighed with a secret pain. That I were free again. Free as when I rode that day where the barefoot maiden raked her hay. She wedded a man unlearned and poor, and many children played round her humble door. But care and sorrow and childbirth pain left their traces on heart and brain. And oft when the summer sun shone hot on the new-mown hay in the meadow lot, and she heard the little spring brook fall over the roadside through the wall, in the shade of the apple tree again she saw a rider draw his rein. And gazing down with timid grace, she felt his pleased eyes read her face. Sometimes her narrow kitchen walls stretched away and away and away into stately halls. The weary wheel to a spinet turned, the tallow candle an astral burned. And for him who sat by the chimney lug, dozing and grumbling o'er pipe and mug, a manly form at her side she saw, and joy was duty, and love was law. Then she took up her burden of life again, saying only, "It might have been." Alas for maiden, alas for judge, for rich repiner and household drudge. Oh, God, pity them both, and pity us all, every one, who vainly the dreams of youth recall. For all the saddest words of tongue or pen, the saddest are these: "It might have been." Ah, well, for us some sweet hope lies deeply buried from human eyes, and in the hereafter, angels may roll the stone from its grave away. Oh, oh, snip, oh. Might have been. Oh. All right, that's getting the summer off to a good running start. Gee, there's going to be more. No, that's all we can take, Don, for this hour. There's going to be more letters to start out. "Dear Mr. Shepherd, my husband Charles and I last Thursday heard you. Was it Wednesday? These days, the days come and go. And Charles and I sat by the fireside and heard you read Maud Muller on a summer's day. And I said to Charles, I told you, Charles, that young man, he isn't as bad as he seems to be. And by George, he wouldn't be there if W.O.R. didn't know that somewhere inside of him is a big, fat, old, rotten, cornball, oleomargarine heart, just like ours, signed a Shraft Lady." Now, speaking of old ladies, this is WOR AM at FM New York. Come on, let's take them down Primrose Path here.
Welcome aboard, sir.
Yes, flying a coop, finally. Getting out of here.
Your stateroom is ready, sir.
Boy, it better be. It cost me enough. Let's go. Boy, am I thirsty.
The captain would like you to dine with him.
That old fathead. Boy, let me in. The bolder, keener
tasting ale. Can I get you anything, sir?
Yeah. I got a list here.
You thirst for adventure, for something new.
Oh, boy,
you
I got to go.
Try a Valentine.
Fly.
This one's different. Bolder.
Now, listen, you're not going
to
sell me a
more
bottle of ale.
Suddenly,
that's
you're
the
a
ultimate
confirmed
adventure,
Valentine
man.
Ale man. Welcome aboard, ale man.
Ah, ale man, yeah. The ale man. That's one way to put it. A man with a thirst for a man we approve. Three of a I suppose if a guy drinks ale, he becomes an ale man. Well, I knew one guy who lived as long as I knew him on that White Lightning. And this is out there in Indiana, of course. out there in Indiana, it's the only place I ever know where they put White Lightning. And I'll tell you where how they serve it, in case you're interested. They serve it lukewarm in tin cups. That's the only way to drink it. In case you're interested, I don't think you can get that at Toots Shores or at the Astor Bar. You know, speaking of the spring, which has burst like a fantastic cake of yeast over us, there's no question about it, but that each one of us, when these days come out like this, and it's warm and hot and soft, oh, a lot of angry ladies calling. Oh, angry guy this time, huh? Oh, you mean somebody just fell over sideways when I read Maud Muller? Oh, boy. That fixes you every time, you know? No matter what you do, somebody's going to like it. Try as hard as you can to get people mad, and what happens? They love it. Maud Muller on a summer's day. That makes Nick Kenny sound like a deep thinker. Martin Muller on a summer's day. It takes a heap of sitting to make something, or is it a heap of living or something? You can always tell a man, I say, by the kind of dog he owns, right? Right. Any man that's kind to dogs is a good man, right, Peggy? Right. Hitler loved dogs, you know. He did. He had two giant dogs, one named Thunder and the other named Lightning. He did. He really, monsters. He loved them. Yes, indeed. You know, speaking of the fact that it is summertime, and I just wonder how many people feel every year at this time an uncontrollable urge of some kind they can't put into any kind of form, they can't put it into any definite shape, you can't say what it is, you can't even talk about it, because somehow it seems like a weakness or something, because you got this. And it's definitely there, and you never think of old guys having that. You know, you walk around and you don't think of old ladies. Can you imagine this little old lady wearing this light purple dress, you know, the kind with the little lace around the top, and she's got this flat hat, and she comes reeling out of a Horn and Hard Arts, and you know, she looks around and the sun is beating down. Well, you don't want to think that she thinks, you don't want to think that she feels any stirring. You really don't, do you? You just don't. You just, so somehow, in America especially, when people get past, I'd say roughly Pepsi-Cola, when they get to the point where they can't take Pepsi-Cola seriously, they are assumed to not have any kind of passions. Not real. Not any kind of passions that really have got any hookers in them. If there are passions, they're passions over things like doilies, passionate over tea or lemon cookies. People like, I guess people really do think old men like to play horseshoes. or quoits and that kind of stuff is a serious thing. I had this old grandfather. He must have been 85 at the time. And he was 6'4". And this, yes, he was. He was a giant man. And this grandfather, till the day he died, retained every last one of his teeth, and they were sharp. And furthermore, he also he had this blonde hair. And my grandfather would sit in the kitchen, and everybody would be running around and looking, and they would say things for grandfather. You know, they'd say things, now don't make so much noise. Grandpa sitting in the kitchen. And Grandpa would sit at the kitchen table. They had this oilcloth, you know, the blue and white oilcloth, sitting there drinking beer. And Grandpa was not a drunk. Oh, no. This guy was the most fantastically... He was a completely dignified guy. He was. He wore... always wore a vest and had a vest on. When he would go out, he would never think of going out without a hat. And he always wore great hats, you know, kind of like a derby. He wasn't 1,000 years old. It wasn't that long ago. He just was distinguished, you know, like a certain kind of people, like General MacArthur, you know, was a distinguished guy. Well, old Grandpa was a distinguished guy. And one day, we're all fooling around. There's about 10 cousins yelling and hollering and hitting in the kitchen, and old Grandpa is sitting there. And somebody belted somebody else, and somebody belted somebody else, and pretty soon there's about 9 guys belting. And all of a sudden, Grandpa reached down and grabbed one kid out of the lot and shook him. You know, just he never did this. He just reached down, grabbed them by the scuff of the neck, and shook them, you know, like you'd shake a rabbit. The guy's head bobs around, his eyeballs flip back, and he says, "Stop it." And they stopped. it was a long pause. And it was at that moment that I realized that Grandpa had a past that did not involve sitting in the kitchen drinking beer and watching kids run around. And you know, for a minute, a little bit, and we talked about the grandpa. The kids were always the same. Boy, grandpa. He was one of these strong, silent guys. He just sat there and looked. He had sort of china blue eyes. And he would look out on North St. Louis Avenue with a completely jaundiced look. Just sit there and look out. Once in a while, he'd go out and he'd go for a walk. And he would carry this rolled-up umbrella. And he would just walk up and down. And he's about 6'4". He's a giant. Oh, absolutely. He did not have an ounce of fat on him. He looked like C. Aubrey Smith, literally playing one of the palace guards. And he would walk up and down. He'd look at the scene. And gradually, as I got older, people began to tell me things about him. It's funny, when you're a little kid, you always assume that the adults around you always were either daddies or mommies or grandpas. They never at any point were a cake of sizzling, hissing, burning, powering up yeast, you know, that kind of thing. Well, I began to put together things, and now I'm very sorry that I never talked to him. Really, you know, I was too little. But I never really talked to him. And it turned out that Grandpa, as I put the stories together, had been one of these guys who when he was a kid, had gone to one of the great universities in Middle Europa. And not only had he gone to this great university, he had been one of these people that you read about in the pictures like the Prince of Liederkranz and that kind of thing. No, really, I'm telling you the story. He had had duels. He had literally had duels when he was at Heidelberg, which is where he went. I didn't know any of this till he was dead and gone years. And they told me about old Grandpa had had these duels at Heidelberg. Well, for crying out loud, you know. Here he is sitting in a kitchen on North St. Louis in Chicago with this beer, looking out at all these, like Uncle Carl. I don't know what he must have thought of Uncle Carl. You know, Uncle Carl who married one of his daughters, one of the most nothing characters who ever lived. And Uncle Carl sat there, you know, at about the age of 9, Uncle Carl lost his teeth just from worrying, you know. And by the time I knew Uncle Carl, he'd just sit there and gum. He'd sit there and gum salami sandwiches. It was a big night for Carl. He'd sit there and gum salami sandwiches and drink beer. And Uncle Carl, he said, and here's Grandpa sitting there in the middle of this nondescript lot. And it turns out later, as I piece the stories together, Don, that Uncle Carl and all these people, of course, they'd all sort of gotten sucked in. But Grandpa, before that, had been one of these university students at Heidelberg. You know, they had the duels and all that stuff. And he had majored in languages. And it seems that at the time when he was living there in Germany, where he came from, the Rhineland, they went around and they got all the top students, the top university students, who were the biggest guys, the toughest guys, and the most romantic guys, apparently. And as a kind of salute to them, they put them in the elite Kaiser's Guard. You know, you had to be over 6.5 feet tall, something like that. You know, that big thing with a hat on top of the head, with the horns and all that stuff. So they put old Grandpa into the elite guard. Well, Grandpa took one look at this and he was buying it nothing. And Grandpa then proceeded to wrap himself up in a Turkish rug or something and smuggle himself out of Germany. And he was an anti-militarist. He smuggled himself out of Germany and hitchhiked his way across the ocean to come to America. Oh, I didn't, naturally. He was just Grandpa. That, you know, just Grandpa. You know, when you say Grandpa, you say, hey, Grandpa, how was it when you were a swinger? You know, how did it happen? Well, well, Grandpa came. Then the greatest story, of course, about Grandpa involved Grandpa's, let's say, the coiled spring side of Grandpa, which apparently is part of the Heidelberg duelists. It seems that Grandpa came over and came to Chicago immediately. In those days, the European guys who came from various countries always went to certain cities. If you were French and you came to America, you stayed in New York, literally. If you were Swedish, you went to Minnesota. Just automatic. You did. You never thought of living down on McDougal Street if you were a Swede. Really weren't. In those days, you went right out to Minnesota. That was the end of it. And every nationality went to a certain place. Well, it seems that in those days, everybody who was from Germany or from that area either went to the north side of Chicago or Milwaukee. Those two cities. Well, he went to the north side of Chicago. And in those days, the north side of Chicago apparently was a lot of prairies. That's why they called it Prairie Avenue. It was really a prairie there. And so he did something that many of the people of that time who were, you know, the funny, they even had certain things they did. There were certain, apparently, there were certain professions that you did when you came over if you were a certain nationality. If you were Greek, you started a restaurant. You did. Most Greeks did. They started a restaurant. If you were a German, what do you think you did if you were a German? Well, you did two things. You either started a bakery. A German bakery was a big deal. You either started a bakery or you started a saloon. Well, Grandpa started a saloon. He was too big for fooling around with strudel, you know? So he was 6.5 feet tall, so he started this saloon. And it was up on the north side of Chicago, in the middle of the German area there. And one of the great family heirlooms is a picture of my grandfather standing behind his bar, which is a gigantic mahogany bar that was carved out of solid mahogany logs. And behind him is this fantastic picture of this unclothed lady. She was at least 19 feet across. And obviously, the picture was not in color, but the lady was certainly in color. It came right out there, even in black and white. There was a lot of lady there. And she was stretched out behind. And there in the middle of all that tremendous glassware and everything was my grandfather standing there wearing suspenders with sleeve garters with a white shirt. And his hair was parted in the middle, and he had an enormous walrus mustache, which he had to the last day of his life. Great big blonde mustache, and he is 6.5 feet tall, and he is standing there, and you see in front of him, in the foreground of the picture, a bunch of backs, sort of hunched over with derby hats on the top of them, and giant steins sticking up. And it was a picture of Grandpa at his first business. Well, there is a legend that to the very last day that he carried with him, and it was the only thing I ever asked Grandpa about. One day, my mother told me this story, and she was telling me this story to show me that I better not get funny around Grandpa, that Grandpa was a man of some substance, and she told me this story. It seems that one day Grandpa was operating behind the bar there with his rag, and he was drawing these great big steins of Pilsner, and he was laying out the Bock beer. And one day a guy came in. Of course, this was the free lunch days, you know. They had all the stuff, the salami, and they had all the summer sausage and the liverwurst and all the stuff down there at the end of the bar. And Grandpa is working there, and two guys got into a hassle over the pickalilly. And they're yelling around and hollering, and they've been hitting the schnapps. And one thing leads to the next, and the two guys are bumping their derbies together. And Grandpa goes down to the end of the bar and looks at both of them and says, will you please stop that? He had a very slight accent. It was a very slight Bavarian Rhine accent. He said, will you please stop? Well, they look up at Grandpa. Grandpa is 6.5 feet tall, ex of the Kaiser Guards, ex of the dueling corps at Heidelberg, and they stopped. Well, they stopped for about 30 seconds. They knocked down a couple of more thimbles of schnapps, and they started again, this time over the horseradish. Well, Grandpa's down at the end of the bar. He comes back up, and he says, will you please stop? We're out on Belmont Avenue. You'll go. Quick. Well, well, there was a little hassle. You know how these things happen. And they decided now, because they had a little more schnapps, they were going to take him on. Well, it seems that Grandpa grabbed the biggest guy, who weighed about 230 pounds, grabbed him by the suspenders, spun him around four times like a model airplane propeller. He took off, and he landed out in the middle of Belmont Avenue, like that, trailing schnapps and a couple of great big fat spittoons, and he landed out there, and his derby came after him. Well, his friend then walked up and down the bar, and he's feeling his oats, you see, the guy that Grandpa didn't throw out. His friend then slowly got mad because Grandpa had stopped the fight. And Grandpa was not aware of this. Grandpa's back there polishing the glass, and the next thing that happened is this guy comes up from behind Grandpa, and he has this great big knife, this big toad sticker, yeah, that they use to slice the rye bread. He grabs the knife from out of the rye bread thing, and he reaches over, and right between the shoulder blades, Grandpa gets it. Gunk! Grandpa turns, what is this? Grandpa turns around and says, got on him, what a thing. He grabs this guy by the scruff of the neck, eyeballs jiggling, you know, and he says, where is your friend? And he rushes out with the guy, and here's the friend just about to make the scene coming back in, you know, with the swinging doors. Grandpa gets both of them, and he bounces both of them together and slides them halhalfway down the block towards DeBercy Avenue. Down the block they went. Grandpa turns around and goes back behind his bar. And of course, all these guys are sitting there, you know, and they see this thing sticking out from between Grandpa's shoulder blades. And one of the guys says, August, the knife. Grandpa says, leave the knife alone. Yeah. He says, what will it be, boys? And, you know, they said, well, I have a beer, give me a beer there. And so Grandpa pulls beer for a half an hour until the assistant comes in. The assistant arrives. The assistant is named Amel. Grandpa says, Amel, you take over. I am back in a half hour. And with that, Grandpa goes out, and right down the Bersey he goes, with the knife sticking out between his... He wears, of course, puts the coats over so nobody sees it there. Puts his straw hat on and goes down to Dr. Faupel. He arrives at Dr. Faupel. Dr. Faupel, I have a knife in the back. Please take it out. Dr. Faupel pulls the knife out, gives him a couple of shots of iodine, gives him a little finger of schnapps. Are you all right, August? He spits out a little blood. I am all right. He pulls up his socks, and back he goes to work. Well, he works there the next 8 hours. And finally, it is time now to come home and close up shop and put away the last piece of rye bread and close off the beer barrels, which he does. He arrives back home, and my grandmother, of course, he comes in the house, and he sits down for his nightly sauerkraut and spareribs. He sits down and opens up the paper. And he sits to read. This is an actual story that came out of my... He sits down and he's reading. You know, he's reading the paper. He's sitting there reading the Chicago Tribune. He's reading the paper. He says, oh, that Colonel McCormick. Oh, yeah. He's reading the paper. And all of a sudden, my grandmother, who is behind him with a big plate of sauerkraut, observes this. She sees the thing on the back. She says, she says, August, you have a spot on your back here. Why'd you get out of... What do you got on the back? Beet juice on the back? He says, oh, nothing. What is you tear your shirt? Oh, you have tear your shirt. And she takes a close look, and he says, oh, little trouble's down at the bar tonight. And says, what is the trouble? And with that, he says, I better change shirts. And he goes in and changes his shirt, hangs it up. Comes back out wearing one of his shirts with a soft collar this time. And it wasn't until 3 days later, after the word had filtered down from all the different people in the neighborhood about what had happened, though he never even thought it was important enough to talk about. And apparently he got about 6 inches of toad sticker in him. I mean, he really got stuck. And he'd go down to see Dr. Faupel once in a while. Dr. Faupel would look at it. It's coming along fine, August. And August would say, fine, it's only the way it should go. And that was the end of it. He never thought any more about it than that. Well, of course, I was told this legend. And, you know, this festers in your mind. You think, it's wow. And old Grandpa sitting there in the chair, and he'd get up once in a while and snap his suspenders, blow the foam off another stein, sip a little bit, put it down, and say, I'm taking a walk down to the corner. He'd say, Ma, do you want any cold cuts? And that would be his excuse for getting out. And she'd say, well, some summer sausage, please. And the next thing I know, he would be going down the street. Well, we'd see him, you know, and all the kids began to know about this legend. But he was such an awe-inspiring guy, you couldn't ask him. You could not say to him, hey, did you, what about the time you got the toad sticker in the back? You just could not, you know, you cannot ask, believe me, you cannot ask Bernard Baruch about when he was 19. It does not work. Even though you might know some swinging stuff, but you can't say, you know, you can't go up, you just don't know what to say. Well, the legend began to grow. It began to grow, and it began to get, achieve almost enormous proportion, because by the time we were in our teens, most of the kids, late teens, Grandpa, of course, now, he's up around, he was about 87, 88, something like that, still 6'5". He's only lost about an inch in the last 400 years. He has still got all his teeth, still drinking his beer, and he would retire to his room every day and read. He was an insane reader in about 9 languages. He was the one mysterious guy in the family. You never heard me talk about him much, have you? He was the one mysterious guy in the family who knew all these things. Everybody in our family, there was a complete slob family. Most of the people there couldn't even, they had trouble reading the Chicago Trib, and, you know, they only write in one syllable words there. But Grandpa would retire with things written in strange languages. He would read Italian. And because this is kind of funny, you know, he would read French. And nobody knew what kind of books he read. He would go down to the library and bring back about 45 books written in these wild languages. He would bring back books in Russian. He would bring them back, and he would sit in his room and never say anything to anybody about what he read. He would just sit there and read. And once in a while, if you were out in the kitchen and people were making stuff and they were boiling up the hot dogs and that, you'd hear him chuckle. He would chuckle. And you know, people said, Grandpa, he's in there reading. That was the Grandpa's reading. And you'd hear this chuckle. The old son of a gun is chuckling over something. Who knows? You know what? Some wild, insane idea he's just come across about the Punic Wars or something. He's chuckling. And then he would come out once in a while. He would carry a book, big book. He'd stick his fingers between the pages. And the book was usually written, as I say, it was in French. It was I never recall him reading English. It was always in some very, and always big, thick, well-thumbed volumes with the indexes and bibliographies and notes and all that stuff, little stars and stuff. Once in a while, you get a hold of him, you look at him, you know, there'd be a pile of them on the kitchen there. And he would come out with his thumb stuck in him, and he'd come out and he'd say, Ma, have you got dinner ready yet? And she'd look up and dinner in those days in this family with about, I don't know whether you've ever seen a real swinging Chicago type family of this type, but dinner, when there was an enormous crew of relatives over, would consist of a wash basin, you know, the kind of big wash things, the copper tub. I'm telling you the true story, a copper tub that had handles on each end. Now, I'm not talking about the round one. I'm talking about the strange kind, the high kind with the rounded ends. Do you ever see those? This is what you boil wash in. And my grandmother had one of these big copper things, and she would fill it up full of water and about 17 pounds of German weenies, Frankfurters, she'd put in there and boil them. And she would have a thing called a Wasserweck. This is a water roll in German. This is a word meaning water roll. And she would get these water rolls down at the bakery, down at the corner. There was a place called Schmidt's Bakery, another German down there. And he would sell her these water rolls. And water rolls are really, they're kind of like, well, they're water rolls. They're kind of like French, Italian rolls, hard on the outside, soft on the inside. And that would be what you'd put your hot dog in. And they would have these great big things full of German mustard. That was the whole scene. That was the dinner. And about 17 pitchers of beer. And about 9,000 pounds of the most fantastic German potato salad you ever had in your life. This is sweet sour potato salad. They never used ever mayonnaise. Just forget this. That's for kids. This was sweet sour with little pieces of bacon in it. You've had that kind. A little piece of, boy, it is great. It's worse than Cracker Jack. The more you eat, the more you want. You can get hung on that stuff, and you just can't stop. And so he would come out and say, he says, Ma, it's dinner ready. And she would say, no, no, no. And he would go back in, and then you'd hear a couple of seconds later more chuckling. It would be Grandpa. Grandpa's reading again. And then finally he would come out, and they would serve all this stuff, and everybody's yelling, all the kids are running around, they're eating the hot dogs and all. And immediately after this, Grandpa would start putting the leaves into the table. They had these big round tables, you know, with the enormous dragon's feet. Have you seen those carved with the big feet? The round table, you know, the round wooden table. And if you look on the bottom, you'll notice that almost all of those feet on those tables have claws, big claws, you know, giant claws. And he'd say, Alfred, will you help me put the leaves on the table? And they would get the leaves, and they would stick the leaves on the table. That meant, he never questioned, it meant that it was time for pinochle. And nobody said, are you going to play pinochle? He would just say, time for pinochle, Grandpa. This is another thing guys of that period were hung on, was this type of pinochle. And boy, are you talking about serious pinochle players. You think you've seen serious gin rummy players? Listen, those guys could remember every hand that was dealt to them since the last day of the Spanish-American War. They would be arguing over pinochle hands that were misplayed by Uncle Carl like 9 years before. Still mad. You should talk by the time. What about the time you trimmed up? What do you want? You don't know how to play the pinochle there. And so they would sit and play pinochle. And they didn't play any of this kid stuff, you know, with 18,000 cards wild or anything like that. They would sit there grimly. There'd be nine guys around the pinochle table. Uncle Al, Uncle Fred, Uncle Carl. Every last uncle. And the one thing that uncles were judged on was how good they were in bidding, how good they were with a meld. And so they're sitting around there, and you'd see these guys hunched down there. You'd see a great collection it looked like a cluster of suspenders, all bent over and sitting there with the cards going. And they used these blue bicycles, and they're sitting there. And once in a while, I will say 290 there. And there'd be a long pause. Grandpa has let him know that he's got a great hand. 290 there, open.
Yeah, will you give me some more beer, Ma?
And she would bring some more beer, and he'd sit and play pinochle. Well, one day, this was going on, and I'm standing out in the next room with my cousin Buddy, and we're talking about this scene. You know, we're now teenagers, you see. And Buddy says, you know, he says, what about this thing of Grandpa and the knife? And I says, yeah, what about it? We're about 15, something like that. And finally, Buddy says, I'm going to ask him. And Buddy goes in the next room, and they're all sitting around playing pinochle. Grandpa's sitting there, Uncle Al is on one side, and Uncle Fred is over there, and Uncle Carl and my father, they're all... Women never got in these pinochle games, by the way. They were strictly masculine, boy, right down the line. So they're playing pinochle. And Buddy goes up, and he says, Gramp, hey, Grandpa. And Grandpa turns. You know, you don't interrupt them at his pinochle game. Hey, Grandpa. And Grandpa, he was a jovial guy, by the way. Incidentally, don't feel that he was grim or anything. He was just so overpowering, so awe-inspiring. You know, he was like Charles Laughton or something. He had a funny look in the eye, but you don't kid. And so he says, hey, Grandpa. And Grandpa turns. He says, hey, Grandpa, is it true that one time when you had a bar over on Belmont Avenue there, or over by Diversity there, is it true that one time a guy stabbed you between the shoulder blades? And there's a pregnant pause, and all the men, I could see every last one of those guys who were all the uncles, suddenly, this was something for years they'd been wanting to ask. You know, you just had that thing, they all look at him. He said, where did you hear about that? And Buddy says, well, I don't know. He doesn't want to say, my ma told me to scare me about you, you know. You can't say, well, you know, my ma always threatens me with it. You know, if I get smart, you're going to reach out and belt me. He said, well, I don't know, I just heard it. He said, I ain't still talking about that in the neighborhood. That's nothing. That was just nothing. I said, well, did it happen? He says, oh, well, it was only a little knife, actually. Just a little knife. There's nothing. That was just a little knife. He says, let's play, Peanut. Come on, let's get the cards going here. Al, it's your deal. Let's go here. He said, well, actually, nothing. And he turns back, and all these guys are sitting there. Oh, and you could just see the difference between the generations. All these little guys are sitting there playing pinochle, and this great hulking guy. Oh, it's nothing there. Nothing, not a thing. And every last one of the other guys were Blue Cross members, paid up all the way down the line. It is nothing there. It's just a little knife. It's all.